This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the uncomfortable question of anti-Semitism in the wake of September 11th. The lid, says writer Jonathan Rosen, is off, and this son of a Holocaust survivor finds himself waking up to his father's world and the menacing rhetoric of history. This hour, post-Holocaust, post-9/11, an American Jew asks if First, the federal government's crackdown on alleged terrorist financial networks. The Bush administration today orchestrated raids on U.S. businesses in four cities, Boston, Minneapolis, Seattle, and Columbus. Evidence was seized at nine locations, including one money transfer business in the Dorchester neighborhood of Boston. Mohammed Hussein, who ran Barakat North America, Inc., was in federal court this afternoon for a preliminary hearing. WBUR senior reporter Steve Tripoli was there. I spoke to Steve earlier today about the charges against Hussein.
Well, Tom, right now there's just a single charge, and it is called conducting an illegal money transmitting business. That's a federal charge, but it's not a very serious one. The maximum penalty is 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. It's major, but not, you know, huge. And that's the only charge right now.
So what is the picture here? This was a check cashing shop in Dorchester, a not unusual and diverse urban neighborhood in Boston.
Well, it isn't a check cashing shop per se. It's more like the kinds of shops where people who have just immigrated from foreign countries send money back home kind of thing. It's a money transferring operation. And basically, money was taken in from various people around the country and sent out. The interesting aspect of this is that according to the complaint, all the money ended up in an account in a bank in the United Arab Emirates.
So that seems to set it apart from other money transfer operations around the country?
Well, it certainly sets it apart in the government's mind. I mean, as Attorney General Ashcroft said earlier today, he is linking this organization here. And by the way, the name of the Boston company is Barakat North America Incorporated. Mm-hmm. And several businesses around the country that have this Barakat name, I guess in Seattle, in Minneapolis, in Columbus, Ohio, were part of today's sort of government crackdown. These are alleged by the government to be tied to funneling money to the al-Qaeda network.
Were there specific allegations of those links and what those ties are or were?
The complaint is absolutely silent on terrorist links. All of the complaint alleges is that they ran an illegal money transfer operation here, and it leaves it at that.
So what made it so jump out, do you think, to U.S. law enforcement?
Well, I think that the reason that they've got this one charge today and have made no explicit connection is that they clearly want something on which they can hold these suspects. Now, only one of the two people named in the complaint was in court today. The other hasn't been apprehended yet, and that was the one who was there was Mohammed Hussein, who is, I believe, 33 years old. And the U.S. attorney who was in court prosecuting the case asked the federal judge that Mr. Hussein be held while he faces these charges because the attorney said because he's not a U.S. citizen and therefore poses a risk of flight. So I think that they're just trying to hold on to this defendant right now and that this charge is a good way to do it. The judge set a hearing for next Thursday, both on the government's request to detain Mr. Hussein and also to show probable cause for why this this charge of illegal money transmitting should be brought to court.
Give us some more of the details that might have brought this particular operation to the government's target zone.
Well, I think that what Attorney General Ashcroft said today is that they have now named this Barakat Network and one other as organizations that are suspected, and again, the word is suspected, of funneling money to the al-Qaeda network. So they're looking at all these Barakat operations around the country.
They moved $2 million out of the United States between or into the U.S., and then right back out between January and September of this year. That must have jumped up. And you said that money was going to the United Arab Emirates. Were there other locales that were involved that would have raised red flags?
Right. There are some interesting things here in the complaint, and I'm reading from it as we speak here. They outline one specific transaction through this Barakat North America account that was held at Citizens Bank here in Boston. And this one transaction was a deposit that contained checks that came from several locations, Orleans, Ontario, Manchester, New Hampshire, Jersey City, New Jersey, and also Roslindale, Massachusetts. That was one deposit.
And why would those have been of particular interest?
Well, I suspect that the reason that these particular ones were placed in this complaint was that, you know, if you hear the name, if you hear the words Jersey City, and again, there's no explicit tie made here. These are words we've heard
but
before.
But there were New Jersey connections to the September 11th bombing.
Right, since September 11th.
Now, also Canadian connections.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And also, by the way, Barakat North America here in Boston had an additional account at a bank in Portland, Maine, and that's another town you've heard about.
Where Mohammed Atta began his journey on the morning of September 11th.
Right. And, of course, the final thing that was traced here in the complaint is that between January and September of this year, the Barakat North America account at Citizens Bank took in $2,041,000 and a bit more and put out $2,015,000. So the investigators say that this is a fingerprint, as it were, of an operation that's moving money in and out, turning it over very quickly, of what could be, again, alleged, a money laundering operation.
So it's not so much in that case maybe supplying terrorists, but just laundering the money would be the idea?
Well, there is the criminal complaint is silent on what this bank account in the United Arab Emirates was used for. But again, it contains a name that is similar to the Barakat name, so apparently they're saying that it's part of this network. Now, Attorney General Ashcroft was a little less bashful today about saying that he feels and the government feels that there's some terrorist tie here, but again, it's all allegations at this point.
What was the scene at the money transfer operation? Did you go by there? Have you seen it?
I just spoke to another reporter who was there, and he said that right now the place looks like it's been cleaned out. A search warrant was executed there today, and there is a U.S. Treasury Department tape across the door that says don't go in there.
We've all seen these. They tend to be pretty humble operations, and I'm struck today by President Bush and Attorney General Ashcroft, you know, spotlighting these places and the arrests and action today as core moves in the war on terrorism. And yet you see what humble, little, often backstreet operations these are. It doesn't mean that they're not part of a network or not important, but what a contrast.
And, of course, you know, $2 million is not a huge amount of money between January and September of this year. But all of these organizations today had their assets frozen by the government, and two individuals, including Liban Hussein, who's named in the Boston complaint, had his personal assets frozen as well. So I think the government is saying that this is a step in drying up the financial assets of terrorist organizations.
Steve Tripoli is a senior reporter for WBUR. I spoke to him earlier today. A nanosecond after the attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the search for answers and blame began. Who could have done it, and what did Americans do to deserve this? There was talk of America's superpower superiority complex, and in the angry margins, there was talk about the Jews. In Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Jonathan Rosen wrote, "I have always known much of the world wanted Jews simply to disappear, but there are degrees of knowledge, and after September 11th, my imagination seems more terribly able to imagine a world of rhetoric fulfilled." Is September 11th, weirdly, an excuse for anti-Semitism? Are generations of American Jews born after the Holocaust now somehow being dragged back into history? And can America support a new kind of conversation about Israel and the Palestinians that does not stir fears of anti-Semitism? Join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from New York is Jonathan Rosen. His article, "The Uncomfortable Question of Anti-Semitism, Waking Up to My Father's World," appeared in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Welcome, Jonathan Rosen.
Thank you.
And with us in the studio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jonathan Rosen, you've written a powerful article, and we welcome the chance to talk to you tonight. We want to work our way into your thinking. Give us your starting point. You didn't grow up obsessing over anti-Semitism, but your father did.
Yes, with very good reason. I wouldn't describe him as paranoid at all. He's a very mm-hmm. rational man. He's mm-hmm. professor of German literature, mm-hmm. Which, after all, was the language spoken by the people who killed his parents and drove him out of Vienna, where he was born. Mm-hmm. But he saw his world destroyed, and he saw anti-Semitic rhetoric translated into genocidal practices. And so he was just attuned, let's say, mm-hmm. to the dangers of history, and he didn't believe that when he arrived in America, evil simply disappeared.
You describe him night after night. I'm sorry.
No, please, go ahead.
You describe him night after night listening to the radio, and as I guess you perceived him listening for news of the menace somehow returning. But you make clear in your own writing that you wanted no part of that. You didn't really relate.
I think that may be slightly too strong, but okay. Yes, I saw myself as living in a different world. I was informed by my father's experience. Mm-hmm. It's a deep part of my identity, my Jewish identity, my American identity, my sense of myself as a human being and the possibility of evil. But I saw myself also as an American with the world all before him, who could do anything he wanted and who would not be defined by religion, in the same way that Martin Luther King dreamed of someone being judged not by the color of his skin. I felt that my religion would not be the reason why people actually wished to kill me.
I don't think we would have really expected on the late morning or afternoon of September 11th to, a couple of months later, be sitting and talking about anti-Semitism. I mean, it fairly quickly everything became focused on Islamic terrorists. What are we doing here? How do we get to this point? How did you come to the point where it somehow came to the forefront of your mind, Jonathan Rosen?
It had actually been growing before the 11th, especially with the collapse of the Oslo peace talks a little over a year ago. I'd been following very intently, you might say, with the same obsessive news hunger that my father had once exhibited, what the Israeli papers, because the violence that erupted was so profound, and there were so many suicide bombings. But after the 11th, the lid really was off something, and what I realized was the extent to which Jews had been systematically demonized by Arab countries. Bernard Lewis, who's a professor of Islam and a very eminent scholar of Islam, has a very important book called Semites and Anti-Semites, and he really talks about the way classical Christian anti-Semitism has been grafted onto contemporary political Arab grievances. So instead of disagreeing with Israeli policies, you absorb, say, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. You see Israel as an outpost of world Jewry. You see world Jewry as a demonic force out for global domination. And you come to see Jews themselves, wherever they are, as satanic. And when I began hearing after the 11th that in Egypt people felt that this was – that the World Trade Center had been destroyed as part of a Jewish conspiracy. When the Syrian defense minister told a group of visiting British students that it was all a Jewish conspiracy. When the imam of a mosque in New York City, who has since gone back to Egypt, mm-hmm. gives an interview in Arabic that was translated and reported in the New York Times, saying that Jews were responsible and that Jewish doctors have been poisoning and killing Muslim children in New York hospitals, you realize the way in which it has actually entered the bloodstream of these societies. And that I find deeply, deeply disturbing for many, many reasons, and partly because it makes the idea of a merely political solution to a terrible situation seem very, very difficult.
Jack Beattie, Jonathan Rosen points out how the old language of anti-Semitism in Christendom has been adopted by the Islamic world.
Yeah, and this is why I think when Christians, quote-unquote, look at this Muslim anti-Semitism, they shouldn't go on a moral holiday. This is about us, quote-unquote, too. I mean, it's the ancient and you know, almost defining Christian and specifically Christian, I'll leave it at that, anti-Semitism that has found its way into the Arab world. According to another of Bernard Lewis's books, the Jews under the Muslim Empire were treated relatively well. They were taxed. They had other restrictions. But compared to what Europe was doing to them. So I think that when we look at these horrible statements, we need to say, gee, this is an infection in the Muslim world. But by God, we, the Christian West, played a part in putting it there.
We're talking tonight with author Jonathan Rosen about his impression that anti-Semitism is somehow having a resurgence post-September 11th. You can join the conversation. Do you feel a new anti-Semitism mounting in this crisis? Or do you feel inhibited in talking about Israel and the Palestinians by fear that you might be labeled anti-Semitic? or that you might subconsciously be anti-Semitic. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. We're taking a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In the movie Gentleman's Agreement, Gregory Peck plays a journalist pretending to be Jewish to get the inside story on anti-Semitism in America during the 1940s. Peck's character gets an eye-opening look and earful from the manager of a swanky hotel when he asks if the hotel takes Jews.
In answer to your question, may I inquire, are you, do you follow the Hebrew religion yourself? Or is it that you just want to make sure?
I've asked a simple question. I'd like to have a simple answer.
Well, you see, we do have a very high-class clientele, and, naturally.
Then you do restrict your guests to Gentiles?
Well, I wouldn't say that, Mr. Green. But in any event, there seems to be some mistake, because we don't have a free room in the entire hotel. But if you'd like, perhaps I can fix you up at the Brewster Hotel, down near the station.
I'm not staying at the Brewster. Look, I'm Jewish, and you don't take Jews. That's it, isn't it?
I never said that.
If you don't accept Jews, say so.
Don't raise your voice to me, Mr. Green. You speak a little more quietly, please.
Do you or don't you?
Mr. Green, I'm a very busy man. Now, if you want me to phone for a cab or room at the Brewster, I'll do so. Otherwise...
Otherwise what?
That was Gregory Peck in Gentleman's Agreement. We're talking this hour with Jonathan Rosen about his impression that anti-Semitism is somehow resurgent after September 11th. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Rosen, the movie clip is an example of the kind of anti-Semitism we associate with America of half a century ago. And you say that you didn't grow up being discriminated against in that way, that that's not what you, what you've experienced. So how are you perceiving anti-Semitism today?
Right. And in fact, the film is an interesting point because it's part of the discussion that America itself had in the aftermath of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. which forced it to come to terms with an ugly aspect of its own society, far less dangerous than what existed in Europe. I am talking about something very different. In Europe, in the 30s and 40s, simply to be Jewish was a crime, and it was a crime punishable by death. And this, in some sense, was the fulfillment of what Jack Beatty was talking about. Jews were cast by Christian society in a role, and they were cast in the role of villain. Mm-hmm. So simply to be a normal Jew in medieval Christianity was to be guilty. You couldn't be normal because you'd rejected Christ, and how could you be normal if you'd rejected the faith that everybody – it would take away from the very reason for this new faith that grew out of Judaism. Mm-hmm. And so Jews could, in a sense, never be normal. And for me, the discussion about Israel has taken a similar turn, and it really has to do with the very right of the country to exist. I don't see such powerful examples of this in American culture, but when, for example, in the immediate aftermath of the attack, someone like Prince Bandar, who represents Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. is interviewed by, say, Larry King, and he's busy saying that we must solve the Palestinian crisis, and nobody asks him how he feels he could do that when his own country does not recognize Israel's right to exist, then you are participating in what I would almost call a big lie. Since for a country like Saudi Arabia, solving the Mideast crisis means dissolving Israel. Without articulating that, people are participating in what is in fact a campaign of intended annihilation, which indeed is what happened when Israel's existence was announced, its independence was announced in 1948, leading to all the sorrows that have followed from it.
And still, somehow your article came across with a feeling of counterpoint. I mean, most of the world's cameras are focused on Afghanistan. The big bogeyman is Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalists and terrorists. And in spite of that big focus, you're feeling vulnerable. Doesn't it seem odd timing somehow?
It does, and it's actually awkward, and it's part of the it was part of the difficulty of writing my piece. I feel very much a part of the American struggle, very much bound up with it. Because Jews have been placed in some sense at the center. Hitler placed the Jews at the center of the Second World War, which after all was a war of global domination he launched with his allies. Nevertheless, the thing that motivated his allies was the destruction of the Jews, which a campaign he kept going even to the detriment of his own military campaign. When you hear, when a CNN correspondent is asked if people in Pakistan he's been interviewing since he's in Islamabad are persuaded that bin Laden is guilty, and he says, no, actually everybody I've talked to seems to think Israel is responsible, then whether or not one wishes Jews to be at the center of it, they are. They have been placed there. They've been placed there by this remarkable, intense anti-Semitism that has made its way into the Arab world and to the non-Arab Islamic world like Iran.
You point out that there are 5 million Jews in Israel, 8 million in the rest of the world, 13 million in total out of a global population of, what, 6 billion, a billion Muslims, and you ask, how did it happen that Israel and Jews are the enemy of so many of them? Jack Beatty, in the film clip we heard, there's Gregory Peck pressing the guy at the reception desk at the hotel. Is that the gentle face of anti-Semitism in America? What do you see out there today?
Well, it's interesting. There's some interesting polling data. According to a recent poll, 63% of Americans basically reject the linkage that people were making, that Prince Bandar and others were probably making implicitly, some explicitly, between the bin Laden's attack and our favoritism toward Israel. The 63% said that because the terrorists, that they attacked us because they don't like our values, not because of our relationship to Israel. Mm-hmm. Only 22% believe the opposite. And in what the Anti-Defamation League calls a classic measure of anti-Semitism, only 25% of Americans today agreed with the statement, Jews are more loyal to Israel than America. And that's down 6% since 1998. Now, this isn't to say that anti-Semitism in America is disappearing. There's a crude version. I mean, according to some reports I've read, there are 50 tapes a day of this neo-Nazi group people send for them. And there's, of course, the genteel Christian anti-Semitism that exists and has always existed, and of which that movie, you know, the sort of Greenwich, Connecticut mm-hmm. sense. But I think these numbers show that most Americans are not making that linkage. They're not feeling that somehow it's Israel that's made us vulnerable, and they reject that idea.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say. We're talking this hour with Jonathan Rosen. He's the author of a New York Times Sunday Magazine piece entitled The Uncomfortable Question of Anti-Semitism, Waking Up to My Father's World. Do you feel a new anti-Semitism mounting in the crisis that we're in currently? Or are you struggling with how to talk about the crisis without slipping into anti-Semitism or being wrongly accused of anti-Semitism? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. I'm a Jew. I'm a member of Temple Sinai, mm-hmm. and I go to Torah class every Saturday morning. But I think I have to say that while there's facts that support Jonathan's concerns, and I read listservs from something called Free Palestine and some others, where there are occasional accusations that, you know, 4,000 Israelis were called the day of September 11th, and they didn't go to work.
Right, told not to go to the World Trade Center, that
right,
thing.
Right, mm-hmm. I have seen that, and I know that stuff is out there, but I would have to say that the big picture is much different. The lens that I put on it, and thousands of Jews such as myself across the country who are critical of Israel, is that what really happens is, you know, three bishops from Episcopalian Church go and picket the Israeli consulate in Boston
yes.
just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately the Jewish community in Boston, some of the leaders, go nuts. And they say, why didn't you say anything about Jews that are killed? Mm-hmm. Now, wait a minute. You know, these are Christians who say that Christian Palestinians are being pushed out of Jerusalem and are being attacked in their homes and schools in Bethlehem, and that the tanks came in and crushed their cars and shot little kids standing next to their parents.
Dan, we take your point. Do you have a question for Jonathan Rosen out of that perspective?
Well, I would just say I hear the anxiety in Jonathan's voice, but I would reassure him from having gotten to know many Palestinians in the Boston area that they could hold two emotions at once, and we should be able to.
Dan, thanks for your call. Jonathan Rosen, are you reassured by this perspective?
It doesn't really – I mean, it's an interesting perspective. It doesn't really speak to what my article or my concerns are about. I'm actually not fearful of people critical of Israel. I am often critical of Israel myself, and I'm not afraid that the bishops who are protesting are going to do Israel in any way. But the scope of the anti-Semitism that appears daily in state-sponsored newspapers in a place like Egypt, a country to which we give $2 billion a year, where they literally run stories about matzah being made out of the blood of murdered Palestinians, seems to me to be something that is creating a culture and a climate that is going to make peace in that region almost impossible.
When you raise that $2 billion a year aid to Egypt a year figure from the United States government, of course, are you suggesting some change in U.S. policy that would improve things?
I think we need to be mindful of the culture of a country. I think we need to be mindful about what they say about us as Americans. There was an article in the New York Times the other day that this same newspaper, which is Egypt's largest, was suggesting that food dropped in Afghanistan was tainted, and that if indeed it is tainted, the United States would be guilty of crimes against humanity.
But you know,
this
Jonathan Rosen
signed it. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry, but I just feel a lot of Americans feeling right now this fear of ending up just standing on the small chip of Israel. And we know how small it is, with all the Islamic world clamoring and blowing up more towers. What do you think? Do you fear that that fear in the American populace, and how do you respond to it?
The fear about what might happen to Israel?
Well, about what might happen to Israel, but I think of this broader American feeling now that, golly, are we isolated with Israel in such a way that we're bringing down the wrath of the billion Muslims on the United States? Is that a fear that you feel yourself in the United States? Do you empathize with it, or do you think it's just misplaced?
The fear that our association with Israel has somehow made us a target?
A target, isolated, ineffective in communicating with the Islamic world somehow.
Right. No, it seemed quite clear to me that bin Laden's hatred of the United States dated, I think he's even said this in interviews, from the United States' presence in Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War. And so the refutation of the charge is actually very simple. Whether people will make that association or not, I'm not sure. I am mindful of it. And I suppose in another way, I make the association myself, having just said that there's an easy way to refute it. Something I mentioned in my piece comes from Bernard Lewis, who talked about how when Christians reconquered Spain in the 15th century, they kicked the Jews out before they kicked out the Muslims, even though the Jews were far fewer in number and they had no army and no political power. And they did that because they were seen as a theological threat. They were seen as a theological threat because they believed it was possible to be saved everyone could be saved in his own faith. They did not simply damn unbelievers. And what Lewis says is that this was seen as extremely dangerous, whereas the Christians recognized in their Muslim counterparts a kind of mirror image, and they felt that the Jewish faith would undermine their absolutism. America itself, of course, by its pluralism, is deeply threatening. We know this when we read portraits of who these suicide attackers and who these suicide bombers were.
Threatening to
so
Islamic
fundamentalism. So for me, there is a certain natural association between the two, and I'm comfortable with that, actually.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with writer Jonathan Rosen about his perception that anti-Semitism somehow, perversely, is on the rise since September 11th. Alex is on the line. Welcome, Alex. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Thank you. Just wanted to bring up something real quick. I think the anti-Semitism in America is actually a byproduct of American culture itself. And if we look back, not long ago, I think it was about a year ago, this person in California that attacked his school children, the Jewish school children. And this was before any of these September 11th action by Osama bin Laden. And another thing I want to bring up quickly is I don't think you have the anti-Semitism that you have here in the United States. I'm obviously not from here. I don't know if you can tell from my accent. I'm from Middle East. But I don't think the anti-Semitism that you have here in the United States is the same as overseas, especially in Middle East. I think in overseas there's a lot of political emotions involved in it, and it's mostly against Israel and not the Jews. And I think Osama bin Laden is using this as a political galvanizer for his behavior or yeah. his view of the world.
We can see that. Alex, hang on. Jonathan Rosen, what about this? Alex is from the Middle East. Alex, are you Muslim? I don't have the answer there, but I think from the notes that Alex is, and he makes a distinction between protest against Israel and anti-Semitism.
Well, I myself would make a distinction between protest against Israel and anti-Semitism. The danger, unfortunately, is with the importation of true anti-Semitism into the culture. For example, what was seen in Durban, South Africa, at this conference on racism. Mm-hmm. The Arab Lawyers League distributed to every member every participant in that conference books filled with caricatures of Jews that were right out of the Nazi era, with fangs and blood dripping. The fact that Israel was the only country mentioned, and despite the fact that there is slavery in parts of the world, despite the fact that Tibet has been essentially destroyed, I mean, the list of grievances mm-hmm. and atrocities is infinite. Israel was the only nation. I do not see that as a political protest. I see that as the demonization of a country, and I see that as anti-Semitism.
Let's get Alex to respond. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm.
My response is basically, I think, I don't know if this is going to be a little bit off subject, but the caller before, I think his name was Dan.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I am a Muslim, of course. I think Dan and I are representatives of the new future. I think
give it to us quick. We're coming up on a break, Alex. Give it to
sure.
us quick.
Sure. Him as a Jewish and me as a Muslim are the future of this world, and you cannot keep going back and fighting over and over these issues about the Israel or the anti-Semitism, and this is just a matter of time, and this has to be dealt with.
What about your perspective makes you the future, Alex?
I think it's going to be from within. I think if there are any changes is from within America. I think from teaching and education, this is the only thing that you can really take care of the anti-Semitism problem in the United States.
Alex, thanks for your call. Jonathan Rosen, we just have 30 seconds, but what about it? You're talking about the past being revived. Alex says that he and Dan are looking toward a future that I guess he's suggesting goes beyond anti-Semitism. Do you buy it?
It's an impossible thing to say. My own feeling right now is that without acknowledging that the evil of the past is still alive, there will be no future. And the thing about technology is that it amplifies the evil will of even a few. So although Israel has a powerful modern army, there are terrorists with the potential of getting hold of weapons that Hitler himself could only dream of. I'm not prophesying the destruction of the country, but I'm saying we need to understand that that is the stated intent.
We'll be right back, Jonathan
Rosen.
Sorry, we've got to take a quick break. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Jonathan Rosen about anti-Semitism. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with author Jonathan Rosen about his perception that anti-Semitism is somehow on the march since September 11th. What do you think? Do you feel a new anti-Semitism mounting in this crisis, or don't you? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Rosen, clearly, in the last year of the revival of the Intifada, and somehow, I think, since September 11th, Palestinians are clearly evoking more sympathy, more attention, at least, among Americans. You refer to this in your article, but are you saying that this is, in itself, somehow an indicator of anti-Semitism?
No.
And actually, just parenthetically, the polls aren't really
Jack
bearing, the polls aren't
I'm
really
afraid
bearing
I can't
that
hear
out.
Jack Beatty. Right,
I'm just going to say the polls aren't bearing that out. According to one poll, 48% of Americans sympathize with Israel in the current violence, mm-hmm. while only 11% do with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But certainly, people in the chattering classes, you hear a good deal more of that.
Jonathan Rosen, what do you think?
I think it's very complicated, and it's interwoven with lots of things. Mm-hmm. I think the absence of an historical context is awful. Whether it's anti-Semitism or not, I simply don't know. I can only say personally that with the failure, the rejection of Barak's offer, mm-hmm. The failure of a counterproposal, raised the possibility and the tremendous outbreak of truly murderous violence. There were 100 suicide bombings as of September 9th, raises the possibility that Israel itself is simply seen as occupied Palestine, which is to say, it isn't about a state on the West, a state for the Palestinians on the West Bank, which I myself would love to see. But it is about actually the destruction of Israel. It becomes deeply confusing because, of course, when Osama bin Laden champions the Palestinian cause, that indeed is what he means. Mm-hmm. That is what Iran means. And if that is true, the failure to distinguish the one from the other really has people participating in what in fact is a call for the destruction of Israel.
And the result is, I guess you say, that you feel Jews being turned into a question mark once again.
Yes, I think that that's true. When you read the European press, it's the very existence of the state that is in question, not its policies, but its right to exist. Europe loves to liken Israel's policies and behavior to the Nazis. When you do that, you demonize them, you put them beyond the pale of normal political activity, and you identify them as a group of people no longer worthy of having a nation.
That is
not different to me from the old canards of Christian anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm.
Let's turn to our listeners. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Stephen is on the line. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Wanted to ask you and Jack and Jonathan Rosen the following question.
Okay.
Could you put into perspective for us, in your view, to what degree is there any anti-Semitism in recent years behind UN resolutions that have condemned Israeli aggression? Am I being too hypersensitive here or naive if I don't consider it as a factor? And which nations do you think are carrying such an influence in the United Nations? And do you think that was a indirect or direct factor as to why the United Nations has not used the UN more frequently in ways that they might have otherwise done at the behest of China and Russia in the Central Asian campaign?
Stephen, it's a very interesting question. Thank you for it. You may give us too much credit. I don't know if we're complete scholars of all UN doings.
Well, the UN did rescind the Zionism is racism mm-hmm. statement of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But the General Assembly is made up of many Muslim nations, and they are consistently voting against Israel in various ways. But I don't think it inhibits the United States from using the UN. I think that the UN has been somewhat rehabilitated in the United States' eye since then, although things like this Durban conference are disturbing when you see the nakedness of this racialist feeling there.
Jonathan Rosen, you have written about the Durban conference. I don't know if you followed the UN more generally and the tenor of the conversation there.
Yeah, I don't have great scholarly facts to add, I'm afraid. But the sheer fact that Syria was just made a member of the Security Council, a state sponsor of terrorism, mm-hmm. to me speaks volumes.
John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
A couple of things. One is the observation is that, and I see this as an opportunity to share the following. One is we should be clear. Arabs are a Semitic people. So it's just interesting that we're describing Arab states and Arabs as being anti-Semitic. So maybe I'm being a little too focused there, but I think it's important because to Mr. Rosen's point, he seems to be a person sensitive to things like caricatures in Durban and what have you. And I think there are a lot of things and images that come into people's minds when they hear anti-Semitism.
Okay, point taken. We'll raise that. What else is on your list?
I think really that's it. I think we have mm-hmm. an opportunity. I think that's what I have to say.
Okay, thanks, John. What about it, Jonathan Rosen? You know, the Semitic culture is far and wide, but you're not rolling with that.
No, for me, it's a semantic distinction. Anti-Semitism has always been directed against Jews, and in fact, by turning a religion into a so-called people, a race, it was a turning point in Jew hatred, which is a word I don't use, but I suppose you could use instead. I mean, anti-Semitism has its own history, and it dates from the 19th century when instead of criticizing people or punishing them for their religion, you felt that there was something about their very race. The Jews were a race, and they therefore ultimately needed to be exterminated. It really had nothing to do with Arabs. It's an unfortunate choice of language, but it is the term we now have, and I think for most people, it's clear what is meant by it.
Jonathan Rosen, you write so persuasively about being an American, a relatively young American, not yet 40, who lived most of your life not really focused on this, looking at opportunities, looking at the future, not thinking so much about the past. What is the uniquely American feeling of waking up to the perceptions that are so much on your mind right now?
When you say the uniquely American experience, you mean the feeling of waking up to anti-Semitism?
Well, yes, and having had a youth that wasn't really soaked in it. Unless I misinterpret your...
No, you're absolutely right. The interesting thing is that, in a sense, it's a global consciousness I've added because I don't feel threatened in America any more, I would imagine, than anybody else who lives here now. I don't feel I'm going to be turned on because I'm a Jew. There's a separation of church and state in this country, a tremendous protection of civil liberties. I feel very much at home here. But the realization of the isolation of Israel and the incredible the divorce from reality that I see when I read from the Arab press, the way in which Israel is spoken about speaks to me directly as a Jew because I too am intended. I too am described since it's a matter of global Jewry, not merely the state of Israel.
Jonathan,
it's partly uncomfortable to have this conversation in America in a sense because the expectation, since we are a country made up of many different people, many different faiths, the idea is that we do all and can all simply get along. Discovering ineluctable, irreducible hatred, as we now seem to have, goes against the grain of the culture I live in and the grain of the world that I grew up in. And it's painful to have it for that reason. I don't want to lose my sense of participating in America in that great, vast Whitmanian way where I see everyone as my brother.
Well, and you say this all redoubles your patriotism.
Yes, and that's absolutely the case.
Jonathan, I hate to make you be brief with a profound statement, but you say if the Israeli experiment fails, then Islam will have failed, and so too will the Christian culture that plays a part, shaping part in that region. What do you mean Islam will have failed, Christian culture will have failed?
We've only got a minute.
Well, in a sense, it's an answer to the point I make that there have been friends of mine who have suggested that perhaps Zionism itself has somehow failed. And what I pointed out to these friends of mine is that you could say the same about European Jewry. Ultimately, the Christian culture around it could not accept Jews. You could say Jews should have left. You could say they should have assimilated. You could say they should have converted. I mean, Theodor Herzl's first idea is that all the Jews should have been baptized at St. Stephen's Cathedral. But ultimately, as great a failure, and to me a deeper failure, was the failure of Christian culture to allow Jews to live among them. I feel that challenge now it faces the Islamic world, too. This needs to be a conversation in Islam as well. Can Israel be allowed simply to exist? That's separate from the political conversation about what will happen with Palestine. I very much hope there will be a Palestinian state. But Israel itself exists. And until its neighbors acknowledge that, it will be threatened with annihilation.
We'd like to see that conversation more vigorous. Jonathan Rosen, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Jonathan Rosen is author of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine article, The Uncomfortable Question of Anti-Semitism, Waking Up to My Father's World. His most recent book is The Talmud and the Internet, A Journey Between Worlds. It's just been published in paperback. Jack Beatty, final thoughts?
Well, yeah, just a couple of stray factoids there. The imam who was replaced in New York by a new man, we just heard of the old man's anti-Semitic statements. This new one is agnostic on the question of who knocked down the World Trade Center. well, we don't know whether it's Muslims. We don't know whether it's Jews. We have to. The evidence isn't in. This is shocking beyond. I mean, the one guy is pulled for his anti-Semitism. The second guy says, well, we don't want to rush to judgment here. This shows the divide that Jonathan is talking about.
We'll stay tuned to this one. Thanks, Jack. You can read Jonathan Rosen's New York Times Magazine article at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage. Around the country, the national soapbox of AM talk radio is filling the airwaves with talk of war, anthrax, and Afghanistan. Kathy O'Malley and Judy Markey are hosts of The Kathy and Judy Show, a morning talk radio program on WGBAM in Chicago. And while the program usually focuses on the personal side of life and avoids politics, since September 11th, some things have changed.
Since 1989, Judy and I have co-hosted a pretty superficial radio talk show. We leave the political and military stuff to other hosts on the station, and we deal with things like hair and relationships and stretch marks and whether or not it's possible to get a good photo on your driver's license. Until September 11th. The next day and the next day and the next day, we've been talking about military actions and national ID cards and vengeance. And in the middle of it all, Judy and I experienced what thousands of people in relationships must have also been experiencing after September 11th. And that's the question, who are you and what the heck are you thinking? For two people who were pretty much used to thinking alike much of the time, Judy and I are finding ourselves in remarkably different places, just like our listeners. We're in very different places on military action, on pacifism, the threat of anthrax, and how much personal freedom we're willing to give up in the name of security. About the only thing we can agree on is that Ellen did a good job at the Emmy Awards. United we stand, one nation indivisible. Heck, we can't even agree, and there's only two of us. Throw in a few hundred thousand listeners, and one thing is clear. When it comes to anything regarding September 11th and its aftermath, there may be a majority, but there is no consensus. We are not a nation of one mind. And all that it takes is an hour of phone calls from listeners to confirm that.
As Kathy said, since we are not a nation of one mind, it's probably no surprise that we have widely disparate views as to the crucial issue these days of what exactly is amusing. So we've invented a game on our show called Funny, Not Funny. What we do is when something comes across the wires or whatever, we line up four random callers and we present them with a joke on an item to see if there's any kind of consensus when it comes to our national funny bone. And so we ask, okay, Linda, roll of toilet paper with Osama on it and the sentence, wipe out bin Laden. Funny, not funny. Okay, Bob, woman walks into her living room and asks her husband, does this gas mask make me look fat? Funny, not funny. The votes are never unanimous. And yet, we have found in the midst of this horror, there is a lot to laugh at, as long as we're laughing at ourselves. One of our on-air discoveries is that even though many of us were accustomed to having had plenty of senior moments before September 11th, we all seem to be losing our glasses more, forgetting our purses more, and doing way more I Love Lucy things. For instance, I personally managed to destroy the microwave at home by setting it for 6 minutes and neglecting to put anything in it. Such a smell. I also raced out of the house one dark morning, having grabbed what I thought was my black wool coat, only to discover I had grabbed my boyfriend's full-length black Chesterfield and thus entered our radio station that morning looking like a completely wool-encased fire plug.
Judy, you were doing that stuff long before September 11th.
No, I wasn't.
You've always done stuff like that.
No, I don't.
No, September 11th doesn't have anything to do with that.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. It's the same as ever.
Kathy and Judy Show is a morning talk radio program in Chicago. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email. The address is special at WBUR.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.